Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
The only thing better than grinding all night for your side hustle is your roommate picking you up with Mickey D's breakfast. The perfect pickup deal.
There's a deal for every morning at McDonald's.
Right now, taste breakfast perfection when you get a warm and savory sausage McMuffin with egg for just $2.50. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal.
Welcome to The Revisit, No Encore's journey deep into the annals of Irish music. My name is Colm O'Regan. For the next hour or so, I will be your guide as we explore five Irish albums from a year long gone by. Now, dear listener, we shall not be making this adventure alone, because joining me in studio are three guests who've fired up their flux capacitors and travelled back with me. So, introducing, first of all, multi-instrumentalist with Planet Parade, who dropped their debut album Mercury not so long ago, Andy Lloyd.
How are you? How's it going?
Very well, thank you. Another multi-instrumentalist, a singer-songwriter, producer, broadcaster, yes, all that, but can he cook? It's Gavin Glass.
I can cook. Hey, Colm, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Don't call me a multi-instrumentalist.
And that voice, well, of course he is a multi-instrumentalist. Yes. He is a one quarter of the De Laurentiis, but around these parts he's known as the brain behind The Revisit. As always, Kieran McGuinness.
Hello there.
1981 is our year in question this year.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago.
It is a long time ago.
First-hand memories are not going to form a large basis of this podcast.
I was at the Paul Brady gig in The Point. No, I wasn't. No, that isn't going to happen too much. But I will say that it was the year that Ronald Reagan was sworn in, and was also there was an assassination attempt on him. You know, we had Pope John Paul II assassination attempt on him. Charles and Di got engaged and married in 1981. No assassination attempts on them. MTV started. IBM did their first PC. Films that were out: Empire Strikes Back, Elephant Man, Fame. It was a year of Fame. You know, leg warmers and all that. and the Ordinary People won the Best Picture Oscar. And the Best Picture Oscar. And the albums that were, you know, huge were Ghost in the Machine by The Police, Computer World by Kraftwerk, Phil Collins' Face Value, Human League's Dare, and the best ABBA album, The Visitors.
Well, we will obviously be looking at...
Arrival is ABBA's best album.
Absolutely incorrect. Do you remember any of that? Do you have any of those albums?
No.
Which one was working as a waitress in a cocktail bar on? Was that Dare?
That's...
They were not my cup of tea. Too much eyeshadow for me.
We're obviously concentrating on more domestic matters from the year. And before we get to the bands that have actually made our shortlist, a couple of, I suppose, notable absentees, so to speak. Bands like Boomtown Rats, The Undertones, even Thin Lizzy, have not made the final cut in terms of what we'll be discussing today.
All of those albums as well, I think. The Boomtown Rats, was it Oingo Bongo?
Mondo Bongo.
Mondo Bongo. That was that. You like that album, right?
I like that. If you can get past Bob Geldof's dodgy vocals, like the music's really good. But,
right. Okay.
And they have a bass player called Peeper Kid, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Who produced the Frames for second album, Fitzcarraldo? Believe it or not.
No way.
Yeah, there's a little bit of information.
Is that his actual name, though, or is that like
no? I think that's
name?
A handle.
That's, yeah. That's a pretty good one, though.
It is.
The '80s are all about handles, for sure. Weren't they?
I think he might have won the lotto as well. Another.
No way.
That could be totally made up, but right. It was a saw doctor I'm thinking of.
Right.
That's good enough.
Yeah, one of those guys.
Well, and they were also, I think it was the fifth or sixth album, like, you know, it was the 11th album by Thin Lizzy, right. Renegade, and I think a lot of people said it was pretty stodgy, and I think there was a kind of some drugs going on.
I think the general consensus, yeah, is that it is one of their drug-addled moments.
There's a bang of smack off it, all right.
Yeah, and the other thing about it is it's one of those albums that there isn't many songs on the best of, you know, yeah. From it, you know.
No,
so
there's no hits on it, really.
I saw a live version when I was listening. I was kind of flicking through the live versions of the tracks, and one of them was called Modern Boys. I think it was Modern Boys. Shit, I might be wrong with that. But it's really, really tired, sweaty looking, you know, Philo on stage. And he goes, "How are you getting on?" And he goes, "Are you ready for a bit more?" You know? He looked like he wasn't actually ready for a bit more.
Even jaded,
for a lie down, you know. So I think that might have been kind of spread out through the album. So they didn't make it.
1981 must have been a tough year. I'm glad I missed it. So we might as well get stuck into the albums that have actually made our shortlist, which are in no particular order. Moving Hearts' self-titled debut album, U2 and October, Stiff Little Fingers and Go For It, and Paul Brady's Hard Station. And starting from the top, this is Moving Hearts.
No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show tears if refuse in the morning. No time for goodbye and no time to ask why. And the sound of the sirens, the cry of the morning. They suffer the torture, they're rooted in cells. They went crazy, wrote letters at night. The limits of pain they endured.
Yeah, kind of a super group before super groups existed, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose formed out of the ashes of Planxty, which is a name I couldn't pronounce until recently. Planxty.
I can
what
recall.
What did you used to call
Plank
it?
City.
Plank City.
I've been slagged about that, but we won't get into it. That's just from reading it all the time and never actually kind of talking about it. But anyway, Moving Hearts, super group. Christy Moore, Donal Lunny, Declan Sinnott, Davey Spillane on Illan Pipes. They went on to be, you know, a huge amount of the Irish kind of trad, and I suppose... this is a Celtic rock album, which is kind of embarrassing to title, but they're all part of that scene, whether it's Moving Hearts or Planxty or any other band that came around that time. They were kind of huge parts of it. It's very political throughout. There's, you know, a lot of trad in it. Obviously there's a bit of rock. The setup was quite rock based, drums, guitars, obviously added to it, Illan Pipes and all that kind of stuff. There's a bit of jazz in there as well. You know, young jazz, which is, you know, I don't know if it's the kind of thing that works all the time.
It was always the steer, that little major, there was one or two many major seven chords in it for me, and the tracking that always threw
much
me.
Sax at times as well.
Yeah, sexual harassment.
Yeah, but there's some really, really good stuff on it. A couple of really good instrumentals, McBride's and Lake of Shadows. There's some slightly cheesy stuff like Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Russian Roulette, which is about how, you know, nuclear war is bad. But then there's a couple of absolutely brilliant songs. There's No Time for Love and Irish Ways and Irish Laws, which are kind of from the show Don't Tell kind of lyric writing, where they describe a scene and let you kind of, you know, it kind of paint the scene and you kind of see what you see in it. But yeah, I think it's actually one of the few albums from this list, anyway, for me. Well, of the long list, anyway. It isn't really that dated. It's kind of, I mean, it is obviously from, you know, that time, and Christy Moore's vocals are kind of Christy Moore light. They aren't the kind of slightly caricature-y kind of way that he ended up being. They're much more kind of, calm and delivered. But I have to say, I think it's a really good album overall. It's very easy to listen to. There's a Jackson Browne cover of Before the Deluge on it, and that's one of the only songs that's a pretty rock, pretty straightforward rock song, you know, I suppose. But
it's a fairly straight cover of, yeah, of the original.
Yeah, and delivered by Christy Moore, which adds a bit to it. The song Landlord is a very rock song, you know, but again, you know, with little, you know, leanings towards trad. But I think it's a really, really good album. As I say, a little bit of cheesiness at times, but overall, yeah, I think it's pretty strong.
I mean, you mentioned Christy Moore light.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah.
No, I absolutely understand what you mean, but I don't know. Am I alone in feeling that it was still slightly too Christy Moore for me? I mean, maybe it's just a product of growing up in this country and hearing his voice when you're kind of 3 years of age. Mm. But I can never connect with that when it's with a sort of a rock and jazz influenced sound like it is on this.
I totally agree. I mean, for me, there's four stages of Christy, but if we kind of like, if we take the kind of the current state out of it, there's the Planxty era, which for me is just raw and it's pure and it's you know, electric. I found Moving Hearts to me was just a little bit like yacht trad, you know. I kind of got back into him, you know, before it got to the character where he was telling,
yeah,
you know,
listening Varna, you know, how are you, Paddy? Get up there and all that, you know, that, yeah, kind of stuff. But like, you know, on that track, No Time for Love, like, it's so raw, and I connect with every word. I really got it in a way that I don't always get with him.
Yeah, it's a great record.
It's interesting as well, looking through this list, where you have like Stiff Little Fingers, who we'll talk about in a while, but like obviously a band from Belfast. Talked about the Undertones, released an album, you know, band from Derry. You've got U2 on this list, who on their next album would write Sunday Bloody Sunday and tunes like that.
And Paul Brady, obviously.
Yeah. Yet, yeah, this is surely the most overtly political record that we're actually going to be talking about.
You know that thing when someone tells you something about something, and you know, like they say, or like, you know, tells you about somebody, like, he, you know, he's a pain in the ass. Then every time you talk to him, you're thinking, this guy's a pain in the ass. You can hear it, even if he isn't being a pain in the ass, it's there. Well, this is the kind of thing where I was like, after one listen, I was like, is this a really kind of political record? And I looked at one of the, because I was looking at this on YouTube, was where the playlist was. And one of the, I looked at the first comment, and the first comment was just, up the rah. And I was like, okay, so this is a Republican album. Then I started going back, and then I was reading, you know, Republican stuff into everything, you know, like McBride's. I was like, well, that Ilan Pipe sounds very, yeah, you know, there's a Republican feel off that. Where, in fact, it is, you know, it isn't always, you know, as overt as that. There's a lot of stuff being covered, but I think that it is, yeah. I think in a way that maybe Stiff Little Fingers is kind of, I was surprised how little that kind of, you know, I didn't think that was very, we'll get onto that in a minute, but I didn't think that was very, you know, overtly about,
sure,
the struggle. Whereas, yeah,
they
but
covered
in a way,
all that ground already, I think, probably, as well. You know what I mean? If they were, if they kept on singing, you know, Suspect the Vice and that, would, you know, yeah, would have got pretty old quick.
In terms of breaking new ground as well, though, like Moving Hearts have always been sort of held up as being one of those bands that, you know, innovation, mm-hmm, in terms of the music they were playing, the instruments they were using, and the combinations that they had. And I guess you can even see now with bands like The Gloaming being hailed as maybe like the next coming,
for sure,
of that.
Mm.
Yeah. The trad has always had super groups, I suppose, isn't it? But I mean, I'd love to play, as a multi-instrumentalist, I'd love to play any instrument as well as Davey Spillane plays the pipes. It's, yeah, just, you know, just to flow with those. I could listen to them all day.
That's in your blood, you know, that thing, mm, of when we hear the pipes. It's like kind of when, you know, rabbits hear kind of cars in the distance. It's that just gets the blood going.
Absolutely. And, but I mean, Moving Hearts went on, and Christy left the band after this. I think Davey Spillane took over. Did he lead vocals? I'm not actually sure, but they went on, and the two albums after this was a completely instrumental album called The Storm. Mm-hmm. And everywhere I looked for Moving Hearts, everyone was The Storm reissue, The Storm live at, you know, Vicar Street or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the DVD of The Storm. So I went and had a look at that, and I actually recognised a load of the songs on it. So it's interesting, they became an instrumental band later, which was, I suppose, a more faithful kind of trad, you know, there wasn't, yeah, as much sax on it, there wasn't as much jazz on it.
A traditional trad?
A traditional trad, yeah. More traditional trad. Yeah,
exactly. Of course, the other funny thing about that record is that, if I remember correctly, Declan Sinnott
at the time said, this is absolutely just like contract obligations. We don't want to make this
really
record. Yeah.
I was not hip to that.
The Storm one?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Apparently so. He went on RTE and said, like, our hands are tied. We kind of have to do this.
Well,
and what do you know?
Far out.
Yeah, it's... When I check the personnel on the album, like a lot of them players like Noel Eccles and I think Davey Splann as well, they end up playing on like the Riverdance album, and that's kind of my go-to album of trad is that Riverdance album. So I kind of compared everything to that.
Sure.
So I was kind of, you know, it felt like you said cheesy, a little bit cheesy.
Well, that's
at times
another, that's
me,
another
like,
tidbit. Bill Whelan was actually involved in Moving Hearts for 1 week and then immediately left because of political differences.
Wow. Oh, right.
No way.
Yeah.
But if you look at the that line, Flan Planksty. I'm saying that right. You know, it's got Brady, it's got Moore, it's got obviously all those people, and then later on, it keeps intertwining whenever there's a big kind of thing. I bet you if you look at the gloaming now, you're going to see, you know, trails all the way back to Planksy, all the way back through Moving Hearts, all the way back probably through Riverdance. Mm. And I suppose if you're...
3 degrees of Planksy.
Yeah, exactly. 4 degrees of Christie. But, you know, before the Christie from the Moore Lagoon kind of took over, I think this is... If you were a fan of Planksy, I think you would find a lot in this, you know. Mm-hmm. And I do think it is hard, you know. It's like pesto. Once you put pesto in something, it just tastes like pesto. So once you put trad into trad rock, it sounds like trad,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
So you kind of can't get away from that, and just even the way Christie sings on this is just brings it back to trad. But I do think like there's a really good feel all through the album, and I don't think it ever gets too lost or too far away from that feel. So that's why it's my album that I'm recommending.
Yeah, I mean, it can't be very easy for guys who are bringing different ideas to the table to gel in that way, because definitely there's no part of this that feels jarring, that feels like there's too many.
It is a very cohesive thing, yeah.
Well, if that album left a legacy, what of our next one? For young rapscallions from Dublin, whatever happened to you two? Yeah, U2's second album, October. What do we make of this one?
Well, as an album, I mean, it's clearly not U2's best record by any means, but why the album is dear to me, and it was something that I didn't get into probably till like my early 20s. Having, you know, Octomom Baby was where I got on the U2 train. That was my first stop when I was, whatever, 16. And it was only when I kind of really kind of got into it that I started to go back. The Joshua Tree, I never kind of got, like, surprisingly enough, I mean, I play kind of folky, deserty rock music, and it was just something I didn't appeal to. It was more when The Sunglasses and, you know, Eno and Lamwell's production and that, but it made me go back and, like, really delve into U2, like, in my kind of early 20s, particularly when I started getting into sound and record production and, you know, just the echo unit as a thing, and
right.
The Edge pretty much like paved the Yellow Brick Road of the echo machine in my mind. But as an album, like, I just think its burning ambition is what sets it aside. I mean, the songs in that laid the blueprints for you know, riffs that they kept snipping, like there's songs like they take 3 seconds of a riff and later that, you know, becomes I Will Follow and The Electric Co and all that. And by the time the band have gotten to Red Rocks and they bring some of these songs alive, like Glory and all of that, it is just a different thing. The band are on fire. They're a stadium rock band where they were kids when they went into the studio in Windmill Lane. It's just for me, it just sets the whole blueprint. I mean, songs like the title track October, like this, it's first time we hear piano on any U2 record. I know it is only their second one, but I mean, that for me lays a blueprint for The Unforgettable Fire, and that icy ambience is the only way I can describe it. And it's before Eno's even touched the band, and you know, they already have this amazing way of creating soundscapes, and they're only doing it as a 4-piece. Still technically a punk band, you know. I just think
but like there's signs of a power trio still here, really, isn't it?
Absolutely, you know. And even from, if you take the power trio away and, you know, look at what Bono's singing, I mean, he's trying to make a, you know, it's their second record, and they decide they're going to do a concept album on their Shalom Fellowship Christianity. So, like, their second album, you know, so what's your second album going to be like? It's a concept album on God. I mean, think of the ambition with that and how cocky he was back then. And, you know, there was all sorts of stuff going on with the band in between that. Adam and Larry weren't that into the God thing as much. Larry more so, but the band could have broken up, you know, because of the rock and roll lifestyle and that. But, yeah, I mean, song-wise, they definitely had a lot to go, but it's what they made on that record just basically paved the way for what was to come.
I find myself agreeing almost entirely. Do you know what it reminded me of? You know, on shows like The Late Late or Graham Norton, and they have some famous guest on, and it's like, you know, but the first time you were in front of a crowd, take a look at this. Yeah. And it's an old video of, like, you know, Rory McIlroy, 8 years old, going like, when I grow up, I want to be the best golfer in the world. And like, you laugh because, like, A, they're kind of barely recognisable, but there's still a little hint of what it is. And B, obviously it's freakishly prescient. And C, you're kind of like, oh, well, presumably that's the sort of drive that ended with the result that you got.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like listening to parts of this album for me. When you hear Bono, kind of like, there's one lyric where he's like, you know, I can't change the world, but I can change the world in me, rejoice. Yeah. And you're like, God, that is your script for the next 35 years, mate, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he was even with that song, I remember reading an interview on him about that, and he was saying, like, even like saying the word rejoice was sketchy for like a punk rock band from Dublin to be like flying a Jesus flag. Yeah. It was really brave, and that's what they were into at the time. Do you know what I mean? This is before they became
Bono
McDonald's.
Doing that.
Sorry,
I think it was Bono doing that. Like,
yeah,
pushing that.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. But I mean, it's you know,
it's kind of weird though. I mean, I think, like, as you say, what it sounds like, it kind of sounds to me like it's all the bits of U2 before they figured out what they were doing. You know, it's like a really good U2 cover band doing a load of U2 B-sides, you know? Right. It's like it's nearly there. The sounds kind of sound almost right, but it just doesn't, you know, there's no Sunday Bloody Sunday or anything yet. There isn't even an I Will Follow, even though With a Shout is a very, very, like, I Will Follow. But, you know, it's not it just sounds like they're trying to find their voices. And in Bono's case, I think actually Bono's got an amazing voice later in his career, but right now he's still doing the very high,
it hadn't revealed
chirpy,
it.
Shouty thing. And I don't think it suited him as well as what he found later on. You know what I mean?
For sure. His voice hadn't revealed itself really at that stage. But I mean, I think there are moments, like even on Glory, when you know, they're out there, Coda is, you know, singing in Latin again, another kind of curveball. But he was getting this tenor thing that, you know, isn't there on the first album, you know, so.
Yeah, yeah. They're kind of like drum fills and intros that you recognise, like, oh, this is going to
totally,
come later, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And you can hear as well, Larry still has that Artane Boys band thing.
Shuffle.
Still so prevalent in him, that kind of militant sort of snare thing. And I think that's kind of what got them to the stadium rock thing. And even, like, you listen to the eight, like, you know, that kind of dun-dun-dun-dun-dun bass. For me, like, that's when they do that on I Fall Down, that is the first time, you know, we hear that Kings of Leon kind of Coldplay when the chorus kicks in. Mm. You know, they were already writing these lines, and which kind of was the blueprint for, you know, stadium rock, which producers are still ripping off now, you know.
Yeah. It's missing, though. It's like, it's missing
songs.
A couple of songs.
It's totally missing.
Do you know what
songs?
I mean? Like, I didn't see this myself, but I read it somewhere that someone said there was, I was looking at various, you know, reviews or whatever, and one of them said every single song in this album is 2.5 stars out of 5, so it's amazingly consistent, but it's just not good enough, you know. Like, and I kind of get that, you know, like the spiritual thing is across the whole thing, you know, the same kind of style, you know, apart from the very Irishy Tomorrow, the song Tomorrow, which is which is unusual for you two, actually.
That's,
you know?
There's Ealing Pipes. That's your man.
Your man from Into
Anew. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a weird one. But then again, you know, later on, he did this thing with Clannad, and there's a bang of that, you know, in a lifetime off it.
Yeah. But that song, October, for me, as you said, it stands, when that comes in, it just sounds like it's from another world, you know?
Yeah.
Just like, it stands head and shoulders, like, feel-wise to everything else. And it's like, oh, okay, you can hear where they're going, you know?
Yeah.
And U2 tend to have a thing where they need a couple of albums in between big albums, you know? So they had Boy, and everyone agreed that Boy was a success, yeah. And it laid the blueprint. And then they had October, and they were trying to, you know, where are we going here? Then they had War, and everyone went, yay, War, you've nailed it there again. And then there was a bit of question and things about Unforgettable Fire, and it was nearly there. And then, you know, it was Joshua Tree, and everyone's like, yeah, Joshua Tree, you nailed it. And then it was, oh, Matlin Home, oh, come on, how are we doing? Yeah. And then it was Acting Baby, and everyone's like, yeah, you know, and yeah. Then it was a pop. But you know what I mean? Like, so they kind of, they do this thing where they readjust and they reinvent a little bit and figure out where they're going. And it generally leads to something good, you know, especially, you know, and then when they get to the 2000s, they have one big success at the start with All That You Can't Leave Behind. And then they have a couple of albums of trying to figure things out again, you know? Yeah. So, like, this feels like one of those figure things out, kind of, where are we going next, sort
of. Sure, well, I mean, I suppose it was also their literal difficult second album, so, you know, I don't want to turn to Andy, having just released his debut work, but do you kind of pick up some of those sounds?
You can hear that, like, it's sort of half U2, it's like diet U2, it's like they're almost kind of becoming U2, and, like, there's, like, you can hear the edge, like he was down the line, like,
yeah.
And the drums are like Larry Mullen with the shuffle you're talking about. Yeah. It's all there. It's just not, there's no hits you can kind of sink your teeth into, you know?
And it hasn't glued together. Yeah. Yet in saying that, if a band came into me tomorrow morning in the studio in 2017 and played all those songs with that pep and piss, God forgive my language, but like I would sign them straight away. I would, you know, I would sell a few guitars and help them out, because like,
that's true, something
magic. It should be said as well, yeah, we're kind of judged, like when we're saying they're not quite U2 yet,
yeah,
you know, but they're, that's a little bit,
they're 2021 at that, aren't they, at that age?
Yeah.
I don't think you can't look at it as if we've never listened to any other U2 album. And like the reality of it is they had bigger, more successful albums, and you can hear the how things were working out at that point. And you know, the fact is it's not a great album. They don't play a lot of the songs live. They don't, you know, how many of these songs are on their first best of, you know, was it one, was it just the October song? I think, you know, I think there's a reason for that, and I think you can, it's a good, you know, one of those things where you say it's a good document of where the band were, you know, or whatever.
Good effort, lads.
I think another brilliant song in it is Fire, and just the rhythm in that song, like, it's just excellent, like, you know. Apparently he lost all his lyrics for this album just before he did it. That was a big story. And he had to kind of make some stuff up on the spot, and he was, you know, pacing around. There was a little story, Steve Lillywhite was, like, getting thick with him because he was pacing around trying to figure out what the next line was. And so what he was doing is he was just singing what came into his head, and he said the lyrics for the song Tomorrow just came out of nowhere. The lyrics for the song Fire just came out of nowhere. But he said he looks back and he sees that those songs are about his upbringing.
And you know, Tomorrow's about the prophecy of songwriting, yeah.
Yeah, it was about his, you know, about his mom or whatever, you know, who passed away when he was very young, you know. So that's actually, you know, it is interesting because U2 are not a band that often leave a lot of experimentation for the to hear. It's generally it's, you know, it's what they think is the best thing, and they've worked very hard and it's very polished, especially later albums. So it's kind of interesting to hear them working things out as they go.
There's mistakes all over the record. Like there's bum notes on the bass. There's actually a bum note on Fire on the bass. But I mean, I think it was done. They recorded in Windmill, and that story, the Steve Lillywhite. I mean, he's screaming on. You're paying £50 an hour for this studio, and you come in and you don't even have your lyrics written. And you know, I think they weren't U2. They didn't have the budget. You know, it was, I mean, I know this is what I meant to say, my band when I was 20, 21 were absolutely terrible. Do you know what I mean? So I think as a bunch of 19, 20-year-old, 21-year-olds, they were pretty on
fire.
Well,
you too, I think they've proven to be fairly outside the mean, you know, like, you know, it's pretty.
I mean, I'd love to hear, like, them to go back and just use the tools of a fort, like that thing where it's not like racks and racks of delay, that they actually just brought it down to that rawness with their songwriting chops so much better. I think they'd be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it'd be interesting as well to see Bono do it, because I guess it's the one stick that he's very often beaten with, is that, you know, like, he's too earnest, and people, I guess, see it as being, you know, an effect that he puts on. Whereas this, like, this is earnest, but it sounds really genuine and really pure as well, that, you know, that this really was just 20-year-old Bono kind of trying to balance his rock and roll dreams and, with, you know, staying close to Jesus.
And dealing with his man, you know, coming of age and kind of learning to deal with that.
From a second album to a third album, and our third album is Stiff Little Fingers. If you didn't care, and there are no words to say, just what it is you mean. But if you feel it's real, it's real, it's real. And as for all the rest, they think you're in a mess. I say that they know best, but you know better. You keep your temper, it proves that you're still alive. Yeah, so for the third record, Stiff Little Fingers apparently decided that they were going to write 10 out-and-out singles, 10 songs that would be radio-friendly, and put them together in an album. It was apparently kind of inspired by looking at how Frank Sinatra used to work back in the day, which is probably not exactly how your average Belfast punk band goes about business. But on this, it's largely successful because there's an energy and an enthusiasm that I think is obvious now, and I can only assume was just as obvious 36 minutes ago. I mean, there's very little wasted movement in that regard because, I mean, like, I think there's two or three songs that go above 4 minutes. A couple of them don't even reach the 3 minute mark. It really is kind of bish, bash, bosh stuff. And there's classic punk sound in here, but there's also, I guess, what you call post punk, even the kind of modish thing. Like, there's a reek of the Jam here.
Big
at stages.
Time. The Jam and the Clash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
They're power punk. For me, they were the SLF were the start of power punk. You
yeah.
know,
and I mean,
Green Day. And
it even opens with like a cover of a Bunny Wailer song. It's like all these reggae influences that they're taking in.
I didn't know that.
Now, as Jake said himself, the singer, he said, like, if he played it to Bunny Wailer, he wouldn't recognise that he wrote it. But it was originally his song somewhere deep inside that. But yeah, I mean, they certainly go kind of all killer, no filler on this one. Does it work?
You looked at me there, and I went, "Shit, I don't know." I think it does. I think it's great. As I said, the Jam and the Clash are really kind of. It's surprising because I knew a lot of the early songs, Turn of Ulster, and all that kind of stuff. And for whatever reason, I had dismissed Stiff Little Fingers as being, you know, shouty, photocopied album sleeve, punk band, you know, right. from the North, angry and whatever else.
And to be fair, it's not like the scene was short of them at the time
yeah,
either.
That's an easy assumption to make.
And honestly, it's not at all. I think it's much more polished. It's much more, I mean, I hope I don't get a brick through the window, but it's a lot more pop than I thought it was going to be. You know, it's very upbeat. Like, they had a big, huge fight with the Undertones for years because the Undertones said that they were hyping the Northern Irish kind of situation for their own gain, and you know, Stiff Little Fingers said the Undertones are playing it down, but like I don't hear a lot of hype about from this album. Obviously, you know, they definitely did it earlier, but this album seems just a lot more like, I don't know, it's kind of upbeat and looking at the bright side of things. Now, there is obviously, you know, hits and misses about domestic abuse. You know, you can obviously hear you know, in some of the other lyrics, you know, questioning, you know, the North and all that kind of stuff in like in overt ways, but the lyrics are reasonably simple. It's very catchy, you know. There's a bit of Elvis Costello even in the vocals. I think it really works in a way I didn't expect. So yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan. I mean, I think it's definitely, you know, it's compared to the. I mean, it's their first album that I really know, but I only kind of glanced over for this to listen to it to refresh myself with it, but. They are pop songs in my mind, and they're good pop songs. I think they maybe got a little too good by their third album, or it just feels a little bit slick in places. Do you know what I mean? Whereas like the brashness of the earlier two records, you know, I would definitely be more drawn to. But I mean, it's a good record, and they're not singing about, you know, the troubles as much. I mean, they do address it a little bit, but. That's good. I mean, they two albums have covered all of that ground. They're obviously trying to grow as artists, and you know,
one of the things that really struck me about the record was just how strong it was in terms of its rhythm section. That it felt like it could allow guitars and vocals, or even an instrumental flourish, to do whatever it wanted, just because the drums and bass were really the building block for everything else.
Yeah, it was one of them albums. It was the one that I probably liked the least of them all. I think, I don't know. It's just. I don't know, it was the type of album I would have liked maybe 10 years ago when I was into that kind of punk stuff, But I think where I'm at now is just, I don't know.
It's hard to dial that guy back in. I know. I mean, I was crazy into punk kind of in my 14 to kind of early 20s, but it was I found it really difficult, you know, even listening to the Undertones and the Rats album.
Same here.
You know, I found it really hard to identify with that guy again. Maybe it's, you know, I'm a dad rocker now and it's just, you know, turn off that noise.
Yeah. Well, at least part of it is going to be...
I didn't feel... Sorry, I didn't feel the Stiff Little Fingers had that at all in terms of the noisy stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I suppose is that when they had set out to write 10 radio singles, it's maybe tying your hands in terms of how much you can slow down or take it easy or whatever, doesn't it?
For sure. Mm. And to go out and to say I'm going to write 10 kind of commercial radio singles from a band that were, like, you know, explosive and, like, I mean, the first time you turn on Suspect Device or Alternative Voice, you're just immediately grabbed... This just lacks a little bit of bite and edge of those early two records for me.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not really aware. Well, apart from the singles, some of the early stuff. So I was kind of coming to this pretty clean, and I was really surprised to hear the kind of there's the bit of reggae stuff. But there's a song called "The Only One," and it's my favorite song on the album. And it's got a real proper skank, like a proper reggae skank. And I was like, it was excellent. It was really easy to kind of like just kind of enjoy, you know, and. I don't know, it's funny, I don't know, like, of this list, there's a lot of bands who are trying to mix things with other things, if you know what I mean. Like, you got Paul Brady, who's going for the kind of folk and trad and rock, you know, you've obviously got Moving Hearts who are doing something similar. U2 are trying to move away maybe from the punk and go towards, I don't know, something a bit more open, some more rock. And you can hear that in this album as well, but I think this is nearly the one that does it best, sort of, because I can't hear... the angry, crazy punk of whatever of, you know, Alternative Ulster, and how much shoutier that kind of song is to this. This is like I don't know about, you know, Stiff Little Fingers fans, but I wonder, like, you know, back in the day when they released this, were people like going, God, you know, you've let go of...
Is this a sellout album, so to speak?
No, but I wonder, would the fans have come to the gigs and gone, Jesus, this isn't the, like, you know, throw my beer...
I definitely think there was a bit of that going on with, you know... Some of the diehard punks just thought it sounded like they were trying to, you know, make it. I remember reading something about that right. A lot of their diehard fans just thought that this is
soft.
Kind of soft and sellout and too slick and overproduced.
But I can't imagine, like, any U2 fans, I'm sure, you know, U2 fans would have loved it because, you know, their direction was probably more, the direction they were going was more like, you know, rock, I suppose, like,
yeah, songs.
Punk. So, like, you know, people only barely notice the difference, but they know that it's, you know, maybe they like the melodies more or whatever, you know. Whereas Moving Hearts would have been kind of new for everyone, you know, in that kind of world, I suppose.
Right.
But like this, I can imagine people kind of getting a bit pissed off, maybe, if it was so different. But I think the album works, and so.
I mean, that is the one thing as well, though, as far as the album working, because in terms of a cohesive thread throughout it, I mean, okay, the fact that they're a little bit calmer and paying attention to pop melodies, that might be one, but it definitely doesn't have that sort of thematic thing that some of their earlier releases would have had, and I guess that an awful lot of punk releases at the time would have.
Yeah, and I think it's that thing of you can't, well, I know Green Day are up there in their 50s doing it, but... You know, I don't think any band could, like, really sustain themselves
doing
that.
Can't stay angry that long.
Stay angry, you know. It's just much easier to love. But, yeah, no, I mean, it was obviously the natural progression for them to go. I mean, it's not we're not talking about going from punk rock into, you know, Meatloaf, rock anthems, yeah. You know, I mean, it's power punk pop, you know, I guess is what I would.
But some of the stuff, like, there's a song in it called Piccadilly Circus, and it's the last song of the original album. And I was just like, it's a very strange song because it's about a guy who left his, you know, went over to London and he got happy slapped, you know, and he's like some lad, you know, out of nowhere hit him on the back of the head. And the lyrics are like, you know, I was really upset and I flew home to Belfast. And I was thinking, like, you know, it just seems. Kind of a bit sort of mundane or something, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just like weird to, like, were they struggling for stuff to write about, or did they feel like that their tank was empty as regards writing about, you know, what was going on in the north. Or maybe it's just, maybe it was just like, you can only write so many, yeah, you can only write so many songs that way.
I think so. And you know, you were saying that there is a lot of the Jam on that, but we also had, like, what's the Jam song, Underground at Midnight, where he gets, I can't remember the proper name, but there is that song where he gets a kicking.
Yeah.
And, you know, picks his teeth up and walks home, and it's, I think it's a little derivative. I don't know. I'd love to know which chronologically.
Oh, yeah. So, but as well, Bruce Foxton played in Stiff Little Fingers for 15 years, the former Jam bassist,
Jam player,
which I was like, oh, I didn't know that, you know.
Yeah.
So there you go. So maybe he was drawn to the Jam-like music that was being produced around this time.
Yeah, there's definitely lines of parallel to be drawn. Our last album on this list is a man who a little later would make no secret of the fact that he was looking to make it, as we said. This, though, a little bit earlier on, and probably benefits from it too. It's Paul Brady, Heart Station. So shut the suitcase, kiss the ear goodbye. Don't let nobody stop you at the door. And close the shutters on this empty room where these crazy dreams come crawling to devour. Second solo album from Paul Brady, and basically, as I understand it, the first that he wrote as sort of a contemporary songwriter. Trad was the background. This was obviously a move into something fairly significantly different.
Yeah, from what I read, it was his first album he did on his own that wasn't with Andy Irvine, I think. And yeah, I loved it. I thought it was really good, especially from the very first song, Crazy Dreams. It's like an instant classic. Like, I don't know how that wasn't a... I've read that it wasn't a hit outside of Ireland at the time, but... years later, I think it kind of re-released, and he was on Jules Holland and stuff, so it did well after. But at the time, I think it was just a hit in Ireland. And
yeah,
it
was
really
covered. I think a load of American, you know, those kind of American country guys that's been covered loads. I think, and you know, bands like Lone Star have done a couple of his songs, and
it's great.
Yeah,
it doesn't surprise me massively because there's a huge like American influence on this album. They sounded like road anthems, some of them.
Yeah, I noticed like kind of links towards like the band and Mark Knopfler and stuff like that. And I checked the dates on it, and The Last Waltz was 78,
right?
And Sultans of Swing was 78 as well. So I wondered if that kind of influence Paul when he was writing it.
There's a huge amount of Mark Knopfler, even
they're best of pals.
Are they?
Mark and Paul.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that you can hear lots of them.
I'm saying
that
I don't think they go camping together, right? Yeah. But they know each other. They're pretty tight. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. Like, there's a lot of maybe one song, I can't remember now, I think it's like the fifth or sixth one, where there's like a synth with a synth thing on it, and that kind of turned me a little bit. But the rest of it's great. Like, the Busted Loose is great. I keep going back to Crazy Dreams every time I put it on. It's just
Heart Station.
Heart Station is great too. I think that song's about, well, I could be wrong, but it seems like it's about you know, the struggles of the 80s and, you know, nobody having any money and that kind of thing.
And the life as an artist. And I think, you know, where the album came from, Heart Station, the title album, I mean, this is a man who's like broke his butt with planks, all these different acts and trying to pitch songs. He was always one of those guys that was cute enough to be trying to pitch in songs to Nashville. It's about the struggle as an artist. And I think him going from being a trad player, essentially, where he was like... I know Brady, and he's like, he's a tough son bitch.
Right.
He really is, like, and he still, you know, would just as easily scrap you as hug you, you know, which is great. Yeah. You know, but I think that album was very much about, you know, him having done all this stuff and the frustration with the industry and with trying to raise a family, you know, and...
Yeah.
But he's like he's a funny character in the way that, like, he was in that band, the Johnstons. Now,
yeah.
I don't know enormous about them, but he said he hated every minute of it, and he was just, you know, doing backing vocals and whacking the guitar, and he hated, you know, he left. And then he joined Planxty kind of as, I suppose, Christy Moore's replacement, sort of at the end of the first period of Planxty or whatever. So, like, it's almost like if anyone talks about the classic Planxty, they kind of talk about the Christy Moore version, so he kind of didn't necessarily hit that. And I know that I know from what I've read, he feels that he hasn't got the recognition that he's deserved. So it's kind of a life of frustration for Paul, you know? Like, there is that frustration that does sometimes come from, not so much maybe from his music, but just from him as a person that, you know, because I know that, as you said, loads of people have, like, he's got a lot of respect as a songwriter and stuff like that, but...
Tina Turner's covered, I think she did something off Heart Station.
No way.
And I think, you know, it was that album that kind of set him up, I think.
Well, there's a track on the last track, Nothing But the Same Old Story, and it's a different thing. Like, I wouldn't really consider Paul Brady to be very cutting edge. I'd consider him to be reasonably, like, he's a balladeer, he's a songwriter, you know.
And classic songwriter.
Classic songwriter, absolutely. Yeah. But I wouldn't ever say, you know... there wouldn't be a lot of edge to him, you know, from what I see. But that song, Nothing But the Same Old Story, like, I think it's like there's a lot of edge in that. And it's something I really wanted then to hear, because his brand of it, I think, would be really interesting. And the second last song, Night Hunting Time. But really interesting song.
There's a groove there that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think for me, like, when you look at 1981, like, for me, it's a real dark patch of record production, you know. Like,
I'd agree.
It just doesn't date well. And Heart Station is an album that it's got amazing songs, but is really let down by its really embraced technology at the time, and the reverbs and everything was just so quintessentially 80s, like early 80s. Right. And it just hasn't matured well, in my mind. The songs always stand up, but... I always, and Brady, like, God forgive me if you're tuned in, Paul, he still carries this slightly cheesy 80s sing around with him still, do you know what I mean? And I've had the lucky, unlucky pleasure of producing Paul on a couple of different occasions. Now, when I say produce, nobody produces him. Like, I literally point at the microphones, and, like, after a couple of times, I was getting confident that I could make a suggestion, but... He's very much hung up on that sound from 1981, like that Whitney Houston sounding Fender Rhodes.
Yeah,
you know, he'd have a real Fender Rhodes there, but he'd go, "Oh no, check out this," you know. You know, it's just sounds like little kittens.
But it's like Paul. Oh, like it's like that thing we were talking about. Christy Moore always bringing a bit of trad to it. I think everything that Paul Brady does, he brings a bit of that kind of soft rock with him, you know?
Yeah.
And while there's really, really good instrumentation and the rhythms in this are really good, I think, throughout. And the lyrics are, you know, they're more interesting than I probably would have given them credit for. So,
no, I think for sure, yeah. And I think they're, as you said, like, there's a little bit of bite every now and then.
But the murderer's line in Nothing But the Same Old Story, I was like, okay, go for it.
He goes there. Lyrically, he can always go into dark places, you know?
Because I mean, he made no secret that kind of certainly in the 90s when he was writing things, I guess that was around time The Island and stuff like that, that he really felt that was going to be his time to sort of catapult to international stardom, so to speak. Whereas this album, I guess a little bit more personal, a little bit more raw, a little bit more honest. For me, lyrically at least, it definitely benefited from that.
Absolutely. You know, and as we said, it's just such a departure from where he'd come from. And it's like that thing of a boxer going for a title fight when you do an album that almost like the Stiff Little Fingers one, where you're, you know, are you selling out? Are we, you know, is this the wrong move to go? It's, you know, it's brave.
I read a review of it, and from the time I found one, and he was like, while Mr. Brady, you know, you know, is doing great stuff here, the anti-English sentiment throughout this album is unlikely to propel him into the top 40, you know? So, I mean, I think maybe there was a certain amount of being brave about, you know, going and playing the UK and singing songs about how he was treated in London. Like, so it's got to be, you know, it's got to be kind of recognised. I think that's really a really cool thing. I do think a lot of songs are kind of long. I think the production isn't great. Yeah. And while his lyrics can be great, his lyrics can also be a bit too... Pally or something like Crazy Dreams, like, while it's a really good song, as you said, I also think it's a little bit, I don't want to say cheesy because that's not fair, but
matinee movie for Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, it's a little bit matinee movie for Saturday afternoon, you know. It's a bit little
I
bit
hear you no it's all there. And it was one thing from having tried to work with Paul is to try, you know, to take that out of him, and he doesn't compromise, you know. He's very much, that is his vision, and this is what I do, man.
Yeah, and I guess that's
fair enough.
But that's, that, totally that's especially enough. Going to be pronounced on the first album that he's written on his own, right?
Mm. Yeah, no, it's like he's kind of one of a kind, Paul Brady, vocally. Yeah. Like you can't compare him to anybody. He touches a Bob Dylan in there, but I can imagine him being tricky to work with. Maybe
whoa, back
yeah,
up there.
Yeah, a little Bob
Paul
Dylan.
Brady and Bob Dylan.
Do you know the way he does this vocal thing every now and again where he goes, exactly where to go, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He does
that
every, yeah, he does yeah. this little thing every now and again. It's like Nobody Knows, you know, yeah. that song. He does little bits of that where it touches a Bob Dylan, yeah. and Paul Simon a little bit. In
yeah,
it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but I hadn't noticed that till you.
But yeah.
His vocal though, particularly on that record, it's all just for me. It's too much
belt.
Like we were listening to it over pizza last night and. Myself and the missus going, oh God, Paul, will you just, you know,
yeah,
do one
tilt.
Verse where you kind of,
yeah.
you know, it's just, you know,
yeah.
try a little tenderness.
Yeah.
He's kicking down the
he
door.
He can do it though as well,
big
you
time.
Know, but
I mean,
yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, big time.
Well, it's interesting that you think like, do you think that this is the album he was going for, the kind of going for it, like in the way that maybe if you were trying to be a bigger band or whatever, you might try and write more openly or you might try and think about how the masses would hear. You know what I mean? Do you think that's in this album?
Maybe in Crazy Dreams. I don't know. Yeah. When you turn it on first, that first song is such a kind of a pop. It's instantaneous. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So maybe with that tune, I don't know. I don't know about the rest of it, but Crazy Dreams is definitely kind of pop classic kind of...
I mean, I think there is still a lot of character writing on it, like Night Hunting and all of that. And,
yeah.
you know, he is, I mean, while there is personal, I think there is a lot of him writing in the narrative of characters that he's created in a Tom Waits kind of way, but not yeah. the way Tom Waits would do it. He does,
no.
Paul tends to do the Saturday movie matinee version, you know, of Tom Waits.
But yeah, like, I mean, there's a line in one of the songs, it's like, I think it's my brother Carl from Boston, he's going to pay my way. And he's got, you know, he's doing great over there and he's got two cars in the driveway or something like that. And I remember, like, thinking...
That is great.
I really like that.
Yeah,
you know,
an amazing line.
But I think, like, that song, I was like, why have I not... Like, I've never heard that song before. And I would consider myself someone who would know kind of the Irish canon, if you know what I mean, of songs or whatever. You know, I've heard them, whether through the radio or whatever. And I never knew. And I was thinking, this is the kind of stuff that I think that I'd love, you know, to hear more of from him. That style of stuff. It just seems, again, that show, no, don't tell thing. You know,
yeah.
that way of writing where you paint the picture and the person comes in with you, like, as I say, the Moving Hearts did quite well. You know, instead of that, whereas Crazy Dreams is maybe a bit more like telling you how they are and, you know,
yeah.
these, you know, you won't live someone else's life, you know, which is like, I don't know, it's not 1981, so I don't know whether I've never heard that before or whatever, but I feel like I've heard it now, you know?
Yeah.
I think... There is just a feeling that on this record, I would say unburdened was the word that jumped to my mind. And maybe, I suppose, with your producer's hat on, does that make sense as well in terms of, you know, just kind of throwing the kitchen sink at it in many ways? Is there an editorial hand that might have been useful here to kind of pull it back every now
Definitely.
And then?
I think it is a little bit, you know, the train comes from the station and it just goes like... Same thing, bang, bang, song, and the songs do go on too long, and there should have been some arrangements snipped, you know, there definitely should have been layers, I think, pulled back, and, like, what for me, and Paul does the vulnerable thing, when he actually does do the show and tell, and lets you in, that is when, like, you know, like... The Island and, you know, Nobody Knows Why Elvis Through It All,
yeah.
like, that sort of, like, yeah. it's just... When he does the poetic thing and is open like that, that to me is great Paul Brady. When it's all layers and it's, you know, he's trying to do the Saturday Night record, that's when he can sort of lose me.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
At this point, it's time to see if we bestow the highest honour upon Annie. We obviously have a bunch of records that fall into our silver and bronze category. A couple of them mentioned earlier. So Boomtown Rats and Mondo Bongo. The Undertones,
yeah, I think it's a bronze for me.
Yeah,
so me too, bronze. Too much vibrato on the vocal, way too much vibrato. Never get over that.
And Thin Lizzy Renegade, but yeah, what of these records in front of us right here? Kieran, you start.
Okay, well, for me, It isn't a classic U2 album for me. I like this Stiff Little Fingers album more than I thought I would, but I don't know if it's a gold record, if you know what I mean. The Paul Brady album has elements of it that I think are absolutely brilliant, but I'm just not there with it for some of the other parts. So for me, I think the album that I would recommend for people to revisit from this is the Moving Hearts album. Not because it's the greatest album I ever heard, but I didn't know it, and I think that there might be something here that a lot of people would connect with. So, and also, you know, if you're looking for an Irish trad record that has Republican leanings, you know, stay away from, you know, the Wolf Tones and move towards Moving Hearts. But anyway, I'm going to say Moving Hearts.
Andy?
I'm going to say Hard Station, just because of, probably because of Crazy Dreams, that tune. I've just been binging on that for days now since I heard it. Yeah, that's the one that connects with me the most.
I would probably connect with Hard Station too the most. I don't think out of the bunch we have any gold albums.
No.
I think we've got some solid bronzes all there. That, like, even, I think Paul's album is the only one I'd give a silver to.
Me too.
Personally.
Right, I must say I think they all have merit, so to speak, but it's interesting that, you know, we're kind of hearing them and thinking, well, what would, you know, kind of Paul's past and indeed future have, you know, as an influence on this record. Same with Stiff Little Fingers, that they kind of got a lot of things out of their system, and then U2, you're talking, you know, what the band was going to become. On that basis, I would probably have Moving Hearts as my one to recommend, simply because it's maybe the album that stands out on its own the most. I'm not sure that you necessarily have to sort of delve into their three albums after or their solo careers and everything else to enjoy it for what it is.
Okay, well, I mean, from looking where we are, nothing has been really, like, you know, recommended gold. So are we happy to leave them all as silver? And we'll leave them all those albums as silver and have, you know, our four bronzes in Thin Lizzy, Undertones and Boomtown Rats.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Let's go with that. Full of diplomacy this evening, Kieran. Good man yourself.
Yeah, thanks very much, yeah.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of our look back at 1981.
Thank you very much to multi-instrumentalist Colin O'Regan.
I learned both guitar and piano till the age of 12, folks.
Counts, still counts.
It does indeed. Yes, thank you to our actually talented guests, Andy Lloyd, nice Gavin Glass, and, of course, Kieran McGuinness. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be back with the revisit in a couple of weeks' time. In the meantime, of course, No Encore drops again this Monday. But until we talk to you again, to play us out,
some Moving Hearts, I say.
I say we go with some Moving Hearts. Talk to you again soon. Take care.
Apartheid, internment, conscription, partition, and silence. It's a law that they make to keep you and to be where they think we belong. They hide behind steel and bulletproof glass, machine guns and spies. And they tell us who suffered the tear gas and torture that we're in the wrong. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show tears or for fears in the morning. No time for goodbye and no time to ask why. And the sound of the sirens, the cry of the morning. They suffer the torture, they rotted in cells. They went crazy, wrote letters at night. The limits of pain they endured, the loneliness got them instead. Gave them justice as justice is given by well-mannered thugs. Sometimes they fought for the will to survive, more times they just wish they were dead. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show tears or for fears in the morning. No time for goodbye and no time to ask why.
in the sound of the sirens, the cry of the morning. They took away Sackville and Zitty, Connolly and Pierce in their time. They came for Newton and Seal, Bobby Sands and some of his friends. Boston, Chicago, Saigon, San Diego, Warsaw and Belfast. And places that never make headlines, the list never ends. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show tears if her fears in the morning. No time for goodbye and no time to ask why. And the sound of the sirens, the cry of the morning. Boys in blue are only a few, but the envy day cops on their beats. CID branchmen, informers and spies do their jobs just as well. Kind of the men who tap phones, take photos, program computers and files. And the man who tells them when to come and take you to yourself. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show tears if her fears in the morning. No time for goodbye and no time to ask why. And the sound of the sirens, the cry of the morning. Tell us that here we are free to live our lives as we please. To march, write and to sing, so long as we do it alone. Say it or do it with comrades united and strong. They'll take you for a long rest with walls and barbed wire for your home. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show tears if her fears in the morning. No time for goodbye and no time to ask why. And the sound of the sirens, the cry of the morning. All you people who give to your sisters and brothers the will to fight on. They say you can get used to this war. That doesn't mean that this war isn't on. The fish need the sea to survive, just like your comrades need you. And the death squad can only get through to them if first they can get through to you. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show tears if her fears in the morning. No time for goodbye and no time to ask why. And the sound of the sirens, the cry of the morning. We'll be right back.
HPN, the Headstuff Podcast Network. See headstuff.org for more details.
The been thinking about McDonald's all day, can't get it off my mind. I can already taste it. Ooh, got my mind on my mouth and my mouth ready for some Mickey D's deal.
There's a deal for every moment at McDonald's.
Right now, get two of your favorites for just $3.50. Mix and match a classic McChicken, a hot and spicy McChicken, or a juicy McDouble. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal. Single item at regular price.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.